The Ringmaster, written by Maurice West and read by Peter Hosking. There had always been for me a curious melancholy about the Japanese landscape, a melancholy heightened by the tortured formalism of life and custom. But here, in this hidden valley, the sadness seemed less. Even the black cloud which had settled over me since my wife's death lifted a little to show at the fringes a faint gleam of silver. All my friends, even my children, in their own grief, had promised me that time would heal the heart and work would dull the heartache. But I had found all too soon that time dragged, and work was a drug that left me in the end with a long, red-eyed hangover. Nonetheless, Tanaka's document was more than work. It was, at least it could be, the challenge of a lifetime. By lunchtime I had still only digested the preamble. By late afternoon I had skimmed the whole document, dense, closely reasoned and heavily qualified in Japanese corporate style, and was convinced that the notion was hugely exciting. I was still trying to come to terms with the stretch and scope of it when I heard the clatter of rotors. Tanaka's helicopter was spiraling slowly round the funnel of the crater to land on the beach at the head of the lake. Kenji Tanaka got out and turned away, crouch-backed from the swirl of the rotor blades. Then he straightened up, waved off the pilot, and stood watching until the machine had cleared the crater rim and turned westward back to Tokyo. He was tall for a Japanese. His hair was grey, but his skin was as smooth as old ivory, and he carried himself like an athlete, supple, sparing of gesture, but poised always to move swiftly. He was dressed in a business suit and overcoat, both tailored in London. His fur hat was a gift from colleagues in Moscow. He carried neither luggage nor briefcase. Whatever he needed was here, waiting for him in the old house hidden among the trees in the small temple shrine where his father's ashes were honoured. There were servants to attend him day and night, but no one came to greet him. Even I, his waiting guest, did not approach him. In this place he required that the rituals of his comings and goings should remain private to himself. So I watched him through the moon window of the tea house. He squatted by the lake's edge and with great care gathered a handful of flat pebbles, testing each one for size and weight. Then he began skimming them across the water, measuring the distances against an old mooring pile to which the gardener tethered his punt. However, the sequence of the throws was more important than the distance. First he skimmed 8 pebbles, then uttered a small explosive, "Ya!" Next he counted off 9, "Ku!" And finally 3, "Sa!" I knew what he was doing because sometimes on our walks we had played the game together. The numbers were the most dreaded sequence in the old flower card game called Hanafuda, which the card sharps used to play in the country inns to fleece the yokels. They added up to 20, and the final 0 made it the worst possible score. He had learned the game here as a small boy. He had learned also that when you threw away the same numbers, you could distance yourself from bad luck.